This is Lachlan Rouston.
This is Ralph Friedman. And you're listening to the fittest podcast in Australia,
The Mind Muscle Project. Project, welcome back to this week of the after show. Oh my God, the computer's going schizo. No, it's all good.
Is it all good?
Yeah, it's all good.
That's right.
So I thought I'd start today. I keep getting this question about NEAT. Non-exercise activity thermogenesis. It's become quite popular. Actually, a few people on the internet have started creating hashtags for it. One of James Smith's friends came up with NEAT up 7 days or something. Mm. So like NEAT up all week round, something like that. And it's just becoming popular because I think it's definitely a really good way to keep us. It's funny the different like anti-cultures that are kind of in retaliation almost, or in reaction to the way that society is slowing down. So like all obviously the massive amount of mental health awareness. I think a lot of people are taking up psychology as a degree at university. Definitely as people sit more and more, we started seeing like standing desks come up, but now I think people are like, oh, standing desks isn't as good. You have to like walk and move around more. And so NEAT is kind of becoming this new thing where it's like, get up your daily activity. But NEAT is not actually I wouldn't count NEAT as like a specific step goal, because NEAT is non-exercise. And if you're setting a specific step goal and you're like hitting it every day, like that is exercise. Like you're trying to, it's like a fixed portion of time. NEAT is stuff that's just happening and you're not even thinking about it.
Well, does it include like if I ride a bike to work?
NEAT? I would say that is your NEAT, because you're just like, you're doing something. You're not...
It's but if like, I crank Eminem and I try and beat my PR time, is it still NEAT?
Well, that's a good question. I would say probably not. If you're like racing and you're like writing down times, you're doing it daily, then probably not. But if you're just like cruising around, because you're like specifically going after an exercise stimulus then.
Yeah, it's NEAT.
Whereas, so like, because in the example that you just gave, right, if it was your NEAT, you would like obey traffic laws. Mm. But if you're trying to beat your time, you're like pumping up the hill. NEAT, you're just kind of like, oh, if I have to get off my bike and walk for a bit, or if I stop and take a call, like it doesn't matter. Yeah. It's just part of your daily. And I think that the step goals are getting like really humongous and potentially don't line up that well with people's goals. Now, I think 10,000 is like a good minimum for most people to hit, but it's not to say you can't be healthy under 10,000. It's just not ideal. Like if you're doing a lot of mobility and you're moving around, you're stretching a lot, you're kind of standing a fair bit, like I would say your NEAT is quite high. Like you have a good amount of NEAT. NEAT isn't just the amount of steps you're doing. So I think what some people are getting confused on is like, oh, if I don't get enough steps in the day, I didn't move enough. But I could easily see a scenario where you don't get a 10,000 step count. You might get a 6,000 step count, but you move a lot during the day. It's just not being counted as steps. And you can, that's why I guess something like a Whoop band would measure those calories, because it's kind of just measuring your overall daily calories, because there are days where you can move around a little bit, but you know, it can be very stressful. You can be in a lot of meetings, you can be talking a lot, you can be presenting, and you would have a high output. Like you would burn a lot of calories if you're standing up in front of people and you're talking. And you know, there are some days when my strain is really high and all we've done is like podcasting.
Well, like coaching, if you coach classes on the floor, that is a really big output.
Exactly.
When you do get a ton of steps, but even if whatever type of coaching you're not doing, you're not getting much steps, man, it's huge output.
Yeah, a lot of our coaches say their strain is higher after a class than it is after a workout.
Yeah,
and it's not surprising. I would just say like with the step goals, don't be so married to them in terms of it being like, okay, if I fell below this number, I didn't get a good day of stepping in or movement in. It's like you got to consider the whole day. I think step is just like the baseline thing that people go to. Like in nutrition, there are some baseline measurements that the government pushes, the government message. And one of them is like, you know, reduce sugar. That's like a base thing that they say, or no sugar. They just kind of have these broad sweeping blanket recommendations. But obviously, if you're listening to this podcast, you're a little bit more advanced in your fitness journey than like never having stepped into a gym before and never considered your nutrition. I think that the getting like tons and tons of steps is not always necessarily a good thing. I think it can actually work against some people's goals. Like if your goal is to gain weight, then I wouldn't be doing that many steps. You know, I would be stepping enough, but I would only be doing the minimum amount of steps, like 10,000, 8 to 10,000.
Yeah, it is an interesting variable. Like I do find when people's, so even just like, yeah, their transport to get to work or something like that changes, you never really think that has a big effect, but it has such a big effect.
Yeah.
Because something like that you do every single day. When you go from like walking to work, getting your job, and then you drive, or then you cycle, you do this, has a massive impact on your output for the day.
Yeah. But also, I think as well with the steps is that people can, the more you step more regularly, the more efficient it becomes. So say, let's say arbitrary numbers, say you burn 200 calories at 10,000 steps, and now you ramp it up to 20,000 steps and you burn, let's say 400 calories. But over time, you'll be going to, if you keep doing 20,000 steps every day, you're going to become better at that movement. And so your calorie output, how hard your body has to work to achieve that goal, is going to go down. So over weeks and months of doing 20,000 steps, eventually 200 calories, sorry, you'll burn 200 calories instead of 400 doing 20,000 steps because you're so efficient at doing it, right? So that's probably another thing to consider as well, is like if you do step often a lot, it's obviously a good thing, but your body, you won't burn the same amount of calories that you used to out of it. And so I think people can get caught in the trap like, oh no, I've got to double my steps again. Let me just close that window.
Well, there are a lot of overweight parking inspectors, and I'm pretty sure parking inspectors do a lot of steps because that's pretty much what they do for a living. So it's clearly not the only answer. I don't know if you ever looked at a tradies whoop results, but tradies get insane activity in a day. People that are like builders, electricians, stuff like that, they get ridiculous amounts of movement in a day.
Yeah, and they start early, and there's actually some new research coming out about, I think one of the Mind Pump guys mentioned it, and I started looking into it, was there's some research to show if you eat the majority of your calories earlier in the day, you actually have a higher calorie burn than if you eat the majority of your calories later in the day. So I think the people that...
How does that work?
Well, I think there's some... basically, the research is showing that there's something to do with how your body burns calories with cortisol around and different hormone levels in the morning versus in the evening, because your metabolism is slower in the evening, right? Because cortisol is lower and all the other cofactors and cohormones that kind of move around the digestive cycle with cortisol leading the way. And testosterone and stuff is lower at night, that that fuel is being used differently in your body. It's probably being stored a lot more, whereas earlier in the day, it's been used a lot more. And I actually have observed this in myself. If I take the same exact breakfast and I eat it, and I knew this because when I used to wake up early for coaching, I used to have the same breakfast, but just earlier in the day. And so if I had like a couple eggs, some bread and a shake, like a green smoothie at say 5 a.m. Before I coached. And then now when I have it, it's probably about 6:30 a.m. From 6:30 to say 8:30 a.m., a 2-hour gap, no change in hunger levels really. But from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m., by the time I get to 7, even though it's still been 2 hours since that meal, I am ferociously hungry, ferociously hungry. And I wouldn't say that the movement stuff has, obviously, we just talked about coaching being a higher output, but that can even be days when I wasn't coaching. That was just the most obvious times. But there are other days where I start my day earlier and I'll have all my shakes and stuff kind of before the sun comes up. And then, man, 2 hours in, I'm like insanely, insanely hungry. I think that it is part to do with that research a little bit. And that's almost why I would discourage people from intermittent fasting, where they kind of just behaviorally, because in that morning period, I think that if you do, like, you eat really good food, you get fueled up, you get full of energy, you are way more productive and you get a lot more stuff done than if you were to take all that energy, productivity, fueling, and put it at the end of your day. It's just your body's naturally slowing down. Obviously, there's outliers, people that function better at night, but for most people, I find, if you're throwing all your calories in at the end of the day and all your training and like you're doing all your creative work, hard work, I think you're just less effective, less productive.
That's why I made the change. I found that I was eating much less in the first half of the day because I was like, oh no, I have really good energy when I'm like light. You don't need to worry about food.
Yeah.
But I found with that then you would, by the afternoon, you'd be starving and then you would have a huge slowdown.
Yeah.
Because you just go, I think maybe your cortisol's higher and you're just like really running hot throughout the early part of the day, and by the end of the day, you're just like so hungry and you burn out, and then you have to eat extra food, which makes you feel even more sluggish. Whereas when I just like spread it out more evenly and put more of the food in the first half of the day, it was like much more even keel.
Yeah, I would encourage people to, if you do feel sluggish, because I can agree with that if I don't have the right composition of breakfast, I will feel sluggish. Like, I've definitely had to space out what I eat in the morning a bit more. But I think if you find the right composition of food for the mornings, you will be more optimal. You'll definitely feel better. But yeah, there's definitely, you can easily overeat breakfast and feel worse. Yeah, for sure. So we had a guy, Matt Bartholomew, in the pod, in the studio last week. His episode won't be out for a few weeks. A really good episode, by the way. I really enjoyed it. He's a powerlifter. Anyway, he talked about, was it a knee injury that he had? He had to stop back squatting for a while. And he was telling me about this machine called the pendulum squat. And I'd actually seen it in the gym, but quite honestly, I looked at people using it and I thought, which absolute spastic would use this exercise? It kind of would say, how would you describe it? It's kind of like a hack squat in terms of it's on an angle. You start on an angle with a foot pad, but rather than the weight sliding in a straight line, it kind of moves in a curved line, the machine. Anyway, so I wanted to keep my leg volume up, but not have to put as much pressure in my back. And so I was experimenting with, because I want to squat twice a week, but I don't want to have to back squat or front squat twice a week. So because usually I find if I do that, that's when it starts to cause some irritation in my back. So I wanted to incorporate a machine, but hack squat just kills my knees.
Yeah.
And it's just, I can't do it. So I tried this pendulum squat because when we spoke to him, he said that he used it to help with his leg strength, but reduced his knee pain. And fuck, I used it yesterday and it is awesome machine. Yeah. Have you used it before?
I have used it before. Right. It didn't go as well for my knees, but you just got to get, I really think, the right machine.
Yeah, this was the Atlantis.
I was on a cheaper version.
Right, yeah, the Atlantis is like the Rolls Royce of this machine. And anyway, so I was using it. And it's, what's interesting about machines when you're just so used to squatting for your leg strength is the force curve is really different. What I mean by that is like in the bottom of the pendulum squat, there's like no weight. No weight whatsoever. But in a weird way, like, with, because it's a counterweight, so kind of as it tips to the top, as the counterweight reaches, so imagine that it's horizontal, right, the weight, the plates are horizontal, or the arm of the movement, so it's got a counterweight on one end and it's got the plates you've loaded on one end, and then as you go descend into the squat, the bar moves from parallel to the floor to like perpendicular with the floor. And I think when it's at the top, because the weights are sitting on top of each other, there's no weight on your back, so it feels really light. And I'm like so deep. And I'm actually in a really good position. I'm like bracing really well. And as I push out of it, the weight comes, it hits you, but I don't know, just in a way that it's like really sudden. Anyway, so I made the wrong weight jump because I put the first 20 on and I did like 10 reps. I'm like, yeah, that was really easy. So I put another 20 on. But I don't know, it like pins you really hard at this one point. And I had to start figuring out at which point that would come, and I had to push differently. So rather than push how you would with a squat, which is more like through your heels, you have to kind of push more through your toes, at least how I was doing it. And that was able to, because I honestly felt like I couldn't get out of it. Like I couldn't figure out, because you can't really like extend your hips to get out of it. So normally when you get stuck in a squat, it's like, cool, drive the knees out, extend your hip, like lift your chest out. Like that doesn't work on a machine. You have to push differently into the machine. It ended up being, I had to like kind of come up onto my toes and push through my toes more, and it was more quad dominant. But I'll tell you what the machine did better than anything, which was like really unexpected, was it actually teaches a really good brace. I don't know what it is, but right at the point where it gets stuck is I felt heaps, like my core like switch on really hard and work really hard in a way that was definitely unique to that exercise. Almost, I think, productive for people who can't brace under a squat. Because I think under a squatting load, when you kind of move out of, or when you drive through the sticking point, you can compromise your brace. You kind of like lift your back or you lose your back position. I mean, how many people do you watch kind of see all the force go through their lower back and they don't brace properly? Some reason it just really makes sure you brace really hard and come out of the squat. But look, I think if you've got a good one at your gym and you have some issues related to squatting, you want to keep your leg strength up, I think it'd be a pretty good exercise to keep in long term. I'm planning on.
Yeah, I mean, it's so good to find an alternative because as much as I love squats, it does put a lot of load through the spine.
Yeah.
And everyone's got to be able to manage that. I would still haven't found an option I love outside of back squatting that takes less stress. The one I do actually really want to try is the one I see Brett Contreras giving to a lot of clients. I know I can make it if I can be bothered go to a plumbing store. But basically, you have your feet either side on a box. So imagine like you're raised up, right? So you got a left foot on like a box, like a CrossFit box, and your right foot on a box, and then you just hold the weights in between your hands. So you could hold a very heavy kettlebell and you squat, but it allows you to keep.
Why would you need to go to a plumbing store?
Because I think he sells, I think you could potentially maybe have it in America, but you just need like a T-loaded thing, so you can just add plates
onto
it. And I remember I made one of those back when I had my home gym with a plumbing saw, so I could do like super heavy kettlebell swings.
Oh, yeah.
Because back in the day, I used to
follow... Plate-loaded kettlebell swings.
Yeah, plate-loaded kettlebell swings. That's how I used to do it, because it was so hard to get kettlebells back then. So I went to a plumbing store, and I don't know anything about plumbing, but you just buy the bits, the plumbing bits, like tubes, and then like a plate in the bottom. So I could just load like 10... I put like 3 or 4 10-kilo plates on, you had a 40-kilo kettlebell. And,
these are not like swings. Bumper plates. These are like small tents. No, like, you're not fitting bumper plates in your legs.
Small metal tents.
Yeah.
But I really want to try them out for squatting because like 40-kilo kettlebell is not heavy enough. I've seen people load this up to like 80, 100 kilos. And that's very heavy on that exercise. Like, it's much harder than a barbell.
Yeah. What was the biggest jump you ever made on your back squat when you were in your room, in your gym, your home gym, which was your room?
What do you mean in terms of...
Like, you know, you ran a few different strength cycles of like Wendler and stuff. Yeah. What was like the biggest jump that you made?
Biggest progress I ever made?
Yeah. Like, what squat PR was like your biggest?
Probably, I think I did a very long time where I did just like a box squatting cycle.
Yeah.
Because they used to recommend box squatting, which I still think is very true, in season for sports, because you get like way less sore. It takes out the just that stretch reflex cycle at the bottom, which tends to allow you to recover better to actually play on the weekend. But I remember I did box squatting, like I think my best back squat was like around 150, and then...
Your back squat.
And I just did all box squatting, slightly lighter weights because it's harder. But all box squatting, just on like onto a milk crate. Eventually snapped the milk crate with the weight on my back.
Did you?
Yeah. It just broke straight through the middle.
You get stuck in the crate? Oh, you got out of it?
I went through the crate, but the bar hit
the safety pins.
So if you could imagine, I'm like in the middle of this crate, like in deep squat.
Was it giving you any signs that it was about to snap? Like, nothing. Was it
creaking? And the funniest thing was, I tell every, like, it was like my pride and joy. I'd be like, dude, did you know a milk crate can take like any weight? Like, I do like sets, 150 kilos on this milk crate. It doesn't worry it. Everyone's like, who would have thought milk crate was so well reinforced? And then, I eventually went straight through the milk crate.
Fuck.
But then I think I went, my best squat was 150, and then I think I squatted 170, all box squats. It was a long cycle, but that powerlifter, a lot of powerlifters teach that message, but probably executed box squat does build your back squat a lot. It does, having said that, it wasn't like a high bar back squat, so I wasn't going super deep with my back squat, so it was very similar.
More carryover.
Very similar pattern to the box squat, but I do think, and I still recommend, I think if you can do a really good box squat, not on a milk crate, it's very effective.
My only issue with the box squat is that people, the general population, firstly, doesn't need it.
Yeah.
When it is done, is that people descend so quickly onto the box. We call it the nutcracker because that weight compresses down through the spine, but it doesn't go anywhere. It goes down into the box, and people sit down so hard, and the box just sends the weight back. So your spine just ends up having your disc just end up getting compressed in between the weight and the box.
See, that never happened to me because the milk crate has like quite sharp things on top of it.
Yeah.
Because it's like it's got little bits of sharp plastic. So if you like went straight down onto that, it would imprint into your bump.
Yeah.
So I always like learn from the beginning, you just like very lightly sit onto the box.
Yeah.
And control the weight. And I would squat more that powerlifting style. So like you'd seriously hip hinge onto the box. Yeah.
Low bar.
You don't just like plummet.
Were you low bar?
Gravity, yeah. Low bar squatting. So, you'd like reach right back onto the box. They did teach you to slightly lean back on the box. So, a lot of weight would be going through your spine onto that box. But you just don't have the impact, which I think is where the injuries happen.
Yeah. I always give people the cue. I always give clients the cue. 50% of your weight stays in your legs. So, like, you know, if you fully relax, that's 100% of the weight on the box, but 50% of the weight stays in your legs, which means like they only sit back onto a little bit. And you can have that slight rock back, but I say no more than half a second. So people spend 2 seconds rocking back, they're too far, just go half a second. So a small rock, come forward and exploit.
Yeah, for general pop, I don't usually teach the rock backs because I'm like, someone's going to mess this up and rock back so far. Yeah. It's going to be
a disaster. I would say we probably have a few little niggles that came out of box squatting that I wasn't too proud of, that we don't really do anymore. But also, I think that it does pose a danger for the spotter when it gets really heavy because people load up crazy heavy on box squats, which is firstly so fucking stupid because, I mean, we're trying to get strong, but it's like a false strong because the problem with box squats with... like big group fitness is we don't have the right height for everyone. It's so hard to get the right height. So what ends up happening is the heights of the boxes are all wrong. And so some people are like way too high in their squat. So they get way too heavy because they're doing a quarter squat to a box. And so the problem is, if you're spotting that, look, at the end of the day, if someone does a quarter squat with heaps of weight to a box and stands up, like, it's not that dangerous. But the problem is if they get stuck, because then they don't really have anywhere to go, and then the spot is kind of reaching over a box. So that's my problem with getting heavy. Not that it's dangerous for that person, but it's dangerous for the for what happens if they get stuck. Because now you've got a box in the way where you'd normally dump the bar. And we have had the bar dump onto a box, and the bar snapped.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, the bar snapped. It bent.
Really?
Sorry, it bent. Yeah, so I came into the gym one morning, and there's one of the old barbells outside, and it's bent. And I'm like, what the fuck happened here? And I just went in, like... They knew straight away by the look on my face. They're like, oh, yeah, we dropped it on a box this morning.
Well, once I was spotting someone from behind, and they hadn't communicated that they were going to just drop the bar back behind them.
No box.
No box. Regular back squat. No, regular back squat. So, they just dropped the bar back. My hands were like...
In the bottom or at the top?
My arms were like doing like to get very close to a guy underneath him, right? To support him, arms around him. They dropped the bar back. So, the bar just came straight into my elbows like a Zerka squat. But this is well beyond my PR Zerka squat. So, I just plummeted to the ground. I just plummeted. Just hit my elbows straight to the ground. But luckily, the plates hit before my elbows hit.
Yeah, yeah. Fuck. How heavy was it?
Like 130.
Wow, fuck. That's a lot of weight to catch the elbows.
my arms aren't the strongest at the best times, but that's way beyond my max curl.
Yeah.
And it just took me... Man, we have a lot of bad back squat stories.
Yeah. It makes me think, how valuable is the back squat to general pop in group class? I think in PT, it's very valuable because you can monitor every rep. But I don't know, yeah.
Hard in the group class.
I mean, we teach it in PT first. That's why I'm confident to prescribe it in group class. But most times I see it in group class, it's just not... Even in Globo gyms, people doing themselves, like, it's a sketchy one. Anyway, we are moving studios pretty soon. I'm pretty excited about that, to Bondi. So, shout out to the 220... What's it called?
2026.
2026. We'll be heading out there soon. So I'll be sad to leave this studio, but it's exciting. It's a good timing for all this new stuff that's coming. And that big announcement is coming. We've actually planned the kind of lead up to the announcement. So we will be working on that soon. You guys will hear about it. And last thing I sort of leave you with before Raph gets into a baby update is... you know, I actually got a little bit of sunburn on the weekend, but you know what I love so much about getting sunburn is the analogy it has to training. I said about four different people got too sunburn on the weekend. Sorry, got too much sun and got sunburn. And I said to them, oh, you've just had too much volume. And they just laughed. And I love it because it's such an easy comparison to training, because it's exactly what it's an organ, right? In your body, your skin. So, it's exactly like any other organ that you try and fuck with, like your muscles, right? Too much volume. You know, you get too much sun and you get sunburned and it hurts. And you're like, fuck, I need to stay out of the sun. I did way too much today. But I'm like, I don't know why people don't treat their muscles the same way. They do so much training. They end up so sore. They can't walk. They're awesome. I nailed it. But no one ever says that about their skin. No one ever gets crazy burnt to the touch that they're applying aloe vera. That they're like, perfect. Exactly what I wanted. No, it's dangerous, right? And I think this... And I know the same thing applies with your muscles and your training. So, I think that's a really good way for people to think about it. Even explain it to the gen pop, your friends, your family, or if you're a coach, clients, is overtraining is like getting sunburned. You've just had way too big of a dose for one day. And in fact, if you want the best looking skin and the tan, what do? You just do a little bit every day. But you don't overdo it. You just add that little bit of intensity, just enough. Like, because if you didn't get enough sun, nothing would change, right? But you want just enough sun that you get a little bit cooked, but you can recover from it. It's recoverable volume. That you come back the next day, you're slightly more tan. So that's how I get people to think about
it. Yeah, it's also like the first day of a cycle is like first day of summer.
Yeah.
Like you always get burnt on that first day. You always get sore from the first day. And then you do that same identical session in like 8 weeks time, nothing. Like you haven't even trained.
Yeah, and think about it, like you get really sunburned, right? What's the next thing that happens? It peels. It's not like your body calms down and then it tans and it just takes more time. No, your body peels and you end up pale again, right? And so if you did the same thing, you would get burnt again and you would peel. And that's the same thing that people go too hard and they take heaps of time off, right? How often do you train? Oh, man. Like maybe once, twice a week, but fuck, I go so hard when I do because I'm making up for lost time and they get so sore. Man, I'm so sore. I can't train for like another 4 or 5 days. But you're just hitting the reset button every time. You're actually not getting any adaptation because it's too much. Your body just hits a reset button. So you actually need a very small amount of training very consistently to make progress. I think that's definitely the piece people miss.
Well, that is always the danger zone. You know, it's like first day of summer, it's the same. There's like all those deaths in football training camps in terms of dehydration and overheating. Well, it's really overheating, mm-hmm. heatstroke deaths. All those deaths, obviously it's summer as well, but it's in the very start of summer camp, even though it gets hotter into it. It's just because people's pores haven't opened up. They haven't really started the sweating. And I even think that's why, like, you know, gyms will get blamed sometimes for injuries. It's like, it's no surprise you got an injury when you joined that gym. You went from no training to 5 days a week.
Yeah.
You know, you've made such a big jump in your volume, and nearly all the injuries I've got, it's always at the start of like some routine I'm more excited about.
Yeah.
It's also why I tell people, like, as soon as they get a knee injury, we're working around it, I'm like, cool, we're going to take like extra care on your shoulders, because so often a shoulder injury comes, because you're like, okay, cool, I like cut my two leg days, and now it's like ski erg, and then bench press, and then just wads that are like muscle to this.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then you get a shoulder injury, and that's why you get a run of injuries.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But just knowing that stuff is super helpful. So, what's the baby update?
Okay, so this is a philosophical thing, but what I've realized is...
We're a month out now, right?
Yeah, we're going... No, we are 43 days, so that's nearly a month and a half.
6 weeks, yeah.
Yes, I think today is 6 weeks.
But it could pop out at any time. 6 weeks is very premature, though.
It can. People have... I think they can keep babies alive now from like 27, like something crazy, but it's tiny. It's not meant to be out. But yeah, some people can have pretty healthy ones, I think, at this point. But it's not coming.
It's not part of the plan.
This is one thing you'll find now, and this is probably the first generation of these babies, but the influence of like the social media and people advertising to pregnant people is like insane now, right? Because you're only pregnant for a short period.
Mm-hmm.
I think also you're very vulnerable for that period because it's like hormones are going... you're like, oh, there's so much to learn, so much to know.
Yeah, yeah.
And they just pump you with stuff to buy. Now, admittedly, there is a lot of stuff to buy. Like, I think we've finally got everything.
What have you got that you didn't think you would have to get?
I knew nothing outside of getting a pram. So, nearly every single thing I've purchased has been things I didn't know. But it's like everything. It's like things to put the food in, things to put the milk in. There's obviously the pram. There's like where to change the baby on. There's like obviously all the diapers. There's like the wipes. There's like the cover. Then we're starting to get into the stuff that they sell you, which is like the different ways to carry the baby around on you.
Okay.
Like things to keep the baby out of the sun. We just got them headphones. We got them like these noise cancelling headsets.
Oh yeah.
So you can bring them to the gym. And they're getting crazy.
It's hard to know if you fucked the kids' hearing up, but a lot of people bring their kids and it makes them more calm.
Well, okay, so the thing is with the sound is that like too much visual stuff is really upsetting for a baby, but sound is generally actually not too bad.
Yeah.
Because in the womb, apparently, can't remember, but it is very, very noisy.
Right, okay.
So it's like extremely noisy inside the baby, but they can't see anything.
So why the earmuffs then?
Just to like help it if it like falls asleep.
Oh, okay.
Just to help it so it doesn't always wake up when things are not. Maybe to avoid hearing swear words when it's super young. But yeah, that is it. So if you ever meet a pregnant person, one of the best things you can do if you want to like just to see how different their world is, like go on their Instagram and just scroll through the feed, and it is just like ad after ad after ad of like just shit you would not believe.
Yeah, right. You know, no, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised.
It's absolutely crazy. But now, yeah, we're finally at the point. I think this is the point where we haven't done it. We're gonna do it this week. It's like the last step is like you pack the bag, so you have like the bag like 100% ready.
Oh, for the pregnancy?
Yes, yeah, so if you have to go to hospital. Like
yeah.
There's so much stuff you got in there. And then the last step, which is this week, which is just really on my to-do list, is like put the car seat in the car.
Mm. I heard that's really hard.
Yeah, that's what our college told us. Apparently, it's very difficult putting it in the car, but then also getting the baby actually in. So, I'm going to use his recommendation and like practice with a doll before.
Get the doll in the seat.
Yeah, just put the baby in the seat.
Oh.
Apparently, it's like quite hard to actually do that.
Oh, that's actually hard.
Yeah.
Oh, I heard the hard part was the putting the seat to the car.
Oh, probably.
Yeah, I've heard that's very difficult. Yeah. There's a business where people actually do that.
No, they put it in for you.
I think I heard it on a show called The Pitch. It's like a show about businesses that are starting up. It's kind of like Shark Tank, but just the audio version.
Yeah.
You know all about that. And yeah, it's like this woman's like a service where she like installs car seats because it's like... they're never installed properly or whatever. Yeah, it's like...
oh, okay, I have heard that. Yeah, if it's not installed properly, it's like a higher chance of danger.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a huge risk. Anyway, what is also a risk is potentially not protecting your eyes. Now, we're about to let you guys in on a little secret. It's our new sponsor. Yes, we've had two new ones in the last 2-3 weeks. But this one I'm actually particularly excited about. Now, as you age, one thing, unfortunately, that goes with... aging is like your eye health. And, you know, I think what's interesting about the kind of landscape of health right now is obviously we're in this digital age and there's all these like negative things that come along with them. And I definitely think because screens haven't really existed for a study, like at least a full generation of studies, then I don't really think we know the full extent of what digital screens and our eyes, like what the true extent of the damage is. Now, a lot more research is coming out and it's not good. Like that's just, I mean, the first ones that came out, when you and I had blue light blockers, it was to increase melatonin production in 2000. And I looked at the receipt the other day on my laptop, 2011, I bought blue light blockers.
I think that's before me. I don't think I had them then.
I think I had them before you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got them so early on. I think that I got them off maybe Optimals or something, some random website. They were cheap. They were just like these cheap $20 UVX ones. I still have all three pairs. I still use one of the pairs. The other pairs are so scratched up. You put them on, you're like blind. But that was like the first time this sort of light could be disruptive to our sleep kind of entered. And now what's kind of the next phase of light is it's looking like overexposure to blue light and green light and these other wavelengths are damaging our actual eyes. And I started hearing about it and I started thinking to myself, you know what? My eyes actually like tripping out on me a little bit. Like I'm starting to lose focus. I'm finding it hard to read towards the end of the day. Sometimes I look up from my screen and everything's blurry. And so I actually got my eyes checked. And fortunately, he just said that what's happening is my eye is not a perfect circle. It's like an oval. So
Is that unique to you or is that everybody?
No, it's just me.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Like it's just a genetic thing, right? So and both my parents wear glasses. And he's like, look, there's nothing wrong with your eyes structurally. It's just how you are. It just means that you have to focus a little bit harder. You have to strain a little bit harder to see things at like a medium to long distance. And he goes, it's usually never a problem for you. He goes, but if you are spending long hours in front of a screen exposed to blue light and only looking at things short to you, he goes, what you're doing is you're fatiguing your eyes a lot. And therefore, when it comes to the end of the day and you're noticing that blurriness, he goes, it's because your eyes are so fatigued and that extra strain that you have to do to focus, to see things in the distance and to see like words in the distance, he's like, your eyes are too tired. And so it seems like your eyes are fucked up. He goes, but they're just really fatigued and they fatigue faster than other eyes. And so I was reading this stuff on blue light and saying how it increases eye fatigue, headaches, nausea, all this sort of more extreme stuff. And I'm like, man, I think I just have an overexposure to blue light now. I'm doing probably like 8 to 10 hours on the screen a day. Yeah. Phone, laptop, TV. And so I started looking at blue light blocking lenses and started doing some research on them. And found some really good companies, but they're only in the States. And then I wanted to find a similar company here in Australia, but I couldn't actually find any of them. There are a few optometrists that you can go to in person, but then you've got to buy a frames, which is like $250.
Yeah, so expensive.
And then they're like, cool, now add $80 to put in blue light frames. And then it's like the only time they do a deal is if you buy two. It's like, yeah, cool, we'll take the frames down $50 if you buy two frames. So you're spending like $500 to get some blue light blocking glasses. And so the difference with the light, obviously the daytime ones, is they're not orange, right? They're completely clear. I was like, this is a fucking ripoff. Like, this is ridiculous. And so it stopped me from buying them. And I've just been constantly worried about my eye health until you found a company. How did you find this company?
Blue Blocks. Man, the way I found it is they sponsor, I don't know if he's like, he's been involved with them like from day one, but previous guest, Chris Gethin.
Oh, okay.
Who we've had on the show. He wears the glasses.
Yeah.
Because I've seen him like on my car. It's like the most jack guy ever with glasses. he's huge. And he was always wearing, he wears the nighttime ones, but mostly because he's working, he wears the ones for screens. And he's like a full health freak. Like he did our podcast walking on a fucking treadmill.
He's full into the biohacking.
And he had like the blood sugar monitor. Like he couldn't have been doing anything more.
Right, right.
Crazy shit on our show. But he was into it, introduced me. I haven't got that real strain. The one I was always interested in was the nighttime glasses. Still use like the really shitty ones, and I had kept reading online like those ones aren't actually the best because there's heaps of spectrums of light that you actually need like good quality glasses for.
Right.
And I just couldn't see very clearly. Like I'd end up taking them off all the time to actually see something. Accurately know what I was putting in my food.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was super excited, and then I realized like we've actually crossed paths a ton. A lot of the guests we've had on the show actually use their glasses.
Yeah. No, it's cool. Ben Pekulski, released him this week. He's sponsored by them as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But anyway, I just wanted to share that story with you guys because I think that, you know, this is one of those things where, like, your eye health is super important. Mm. Like, imagine, like, your eyesight deteriorating now. And for those of you who have deteriorated eyes and need glasses and stuff, you obviously know this better than anyone. But, yeah, like, you take it for granted, right? Take good eye health for granted. And I just didn't want to be here in, like, 10 years going, and all the studies come out. And they're like, yeah, blue light really fucks your eyes up. And now all people who look at screens in an office are now required to wear these safety glasses that block blue light. That could happen. In the future, that could, right? It could definitely happen. And I think we just don't have the information, the data, and the research there yet. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to take precaution. And so, what?
I'll tell you a funny story on it. Just to show you, like, this is a good example, I think, of how doctors, obviously, they know their stuff very well, but they can become, like, a bit behind and very skeptical on, like, newer stuff, particularly stuff around, like, optimal health. A while ago, my girlfriend had to have her appendix out.
Mm.
So, we, like, rushed to the hospital. It was, like, whatever, midnight, or it was really late by the time we actually got in to see the doctor. I was wearing my old blue light blocking glasses. I'm like, oh, you know, I want
the UVX ones. Yeah,
yeah, the UVX one. I want some decent sleep when I get home.
Yeah.
And this doctor is like, what are you wearing?
I think I remember this.
And I was like, dude, this is like better for my sleep. It's like better for your melatonin release. And he just started laughing at me.
Yeah.
And walked away. But yeah, I mean, they're just not the people for living optimally.
Well, science, like, they're even a further step removed from science because they don't even, the stuff that comes out in research takes ages before it goes into studies, like into the curriculum at university. So they're years behind.
And I'm sure they just got bigger priorities, but I feel like, dude, we've got to raise money to, like, find out about blue light blocking glasses so people can get better quality sleep. So, like, dude, people are dying of cancer.
Yeah, yeah.
You disgusting person.
Yeah, it's totally different. But anyway, so if this is something you guys are interested in, you can check out this company, Blue Blocks, BLUBLOX, yep. Worldwide shipping. If you type in the code MMP, one word, three letters, MMP, you'll get 15% off any order. So, check it out, guys. I have the Lennon glasses, so I look like Harry Potter. I should probably post a photo of it on my Instagram. I've posted it a few times since then without tagging them, but if you follow me on Instagram, I'll post another photo. But yeah, Blue Blocks, BLUBLOX. .com and MMP, 15% off. All right, let's get into the listener questions.
All right, first question. This is from Gus McLennan. I have been listening to the podcast since I started CrossFit about 2.5 years ago. Awesome. I am in my mid-40s and recognize that mobility, particularly lower back and shoulders, is impacting my progression on both strength and technique fronts. I will add that I think that is every person in their mid-40s doing CrossFit. What mobility content sources, free and or paid, would you recommend for reasonably fit but tight as fuck blokes? Thanks. Clearly Australian messaging in. Good question. I'll probably start with what I don't recommend. I don't recommend Romwood, which I know is, like, super popular with a lot of people. I think it's great if you just enjoy that sort of yoga and like a wind down tool. I think it works really well. But when people, like, I have, like, a specific problem in my shoulders that needs addressing, like my thoracic spine is really tight or my hips are, like, you know, very often there's maybe a side-to-side difference, maybe a hip internal rotation on one hip is poorer than the other. Just like an extremely general approach, like Romwood, that doesn't target anywhere and it's just like passive stretches.
Mm.
It might slowly over time address those issues, but it is definitely not the fastest and most effective way to get to them. And like my time is quite limited. I'm sure everybody's is. So like if I have some time to stretch, it's going to be like the most effective things on what I need to stretch. Because you might find that you spend like the whole class on the one area you really already have too much mobility.
Mm.
You know, it's not targeted at all. In the same way, just doing like general exercises around the gym probably isn't the best approach. I think that's particularly the case. And I think because it's just all only long passive holds, I haven't seen it that effective. I've seen lots of people do it for a very long period of time and they improve some of the positions, but their training looks the same.
Yep.
Like how they actually move in the gym is the same. And if that is exactly the same, I think their performance is going to be similar and their injury risk is going to be similar.
Yeah, well, it's like we talked about earlier. It's like the box squat, right? It doesn't necessarily translate over into a high bar back squat. Mm-hmm. They're just different movements and they have different purposes. And I think everyone relates lumps kind of stretching and rolling and mobility all into this one thing of becoming more flexible and more strong. And they're completely different practices. Like someone that gets better at yoga and gets better at downward dog and can now put their knee on their head on their knee in a stretch they couldn't before. They've improved the static stretching ability in that movement. But they haven't actually translated that and had it carry over into anything else. So I think if you're trying to improve particular movements in CrossFit, you have to do more stuff that looks like that. Now, anything with weight, anything that require, well, the thing about weight is it does require some element of your, so in passive stretching, you can go completely relaxed, right? So the muscle fibers can completely lengthen and you're telling your brain everything's safe, everything's okay. No need to be strong here. Mm. We're just going to get in deep into this range of motion as possible because there is no threat, no danger here. So your body allows you to go into it. But because you don't, you're not sending any sort of signal to that area for resistance, you don't create any strength, right? So you just become really relaxed and really floppy in that range. Now, that doesn't really have much carryover to anything unless you're just trying to get good at passive stretching, which if you get too good at it, you can become destabilized. Mm. But it's pretty hard to do that. I think you've got to be pretty extreme.
I think that's a tight as fuck mid-40s guy.
Yeah, I don't think it's unlikely going to happen. Yeah, any danger. But the best thing you can do is add resistance to your stretches. So, for example, an easy one to think of is like you could sit in the bottom of a squat and kind of bounce around and, you know, there is a little bit of resistance there with your body weight and you can use the pole to kind of pivot on your hip and stretch it. But what's better, I find, is to front load, say, like a goblet squat or a sandbag squat and instead try and get depth through that. So, because you're actively resisting that, but it's also light enough that you can kind of hold it for a long time. And you are kind of pushing into the stretch, but you can't push that far because you are also trying to resist the weight and you're trying to hold your positions and hold the tension. And if and using that weight allows you to kind of access, you know, you're probably only getting a little bit, maybe 5% here, you know, if that. But over time, that's a lot. And that's what you really want to work on. The problem is that people use, they ramp that. That weight in theory could work heavier and heavier and heavier. But the problem is you go too heavy, your body's not going to want to go down there because it's scared. It's not strong in those ranges. So you need just enough weight that you can go to new ranges of motion and it's heavy enough so that you do need to create some resistance that you can't just fully relax into that position.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's a combination, right? Like some people, like just if you just do one path, it's usually not going to be the quickest, the most effective way to get there and to get your body to respond. I think particularly, you know, when you're stronger and you're older, you need like a serious stimulus to get your body to actually make a change. Like 90 seconds of like a hamstring stretch is not going to do anything.
Nothing.
But in terms of the actual resources, I would say the two people that probably made the biggest difference in terms of mobility, I would do obviously be Kelly Starrett. And I think his stuff has also improved a lot. And sometimes people rag on it, but they're looking at like what he brought out 10 years ago and then they judge it now. And I think he's got his new product, the Ready State, which is like much more just like comprehensive about getting your tissues and positions ready for sport. I think that's really good. And then we never had him on the show, but Andrea Spiner.
Yeah.
I still use tons of the different work he's done, working on my hip internal rotation and like its active ability to move into those ranges. Has been like outstanding for my hips.
Yeah, if you don't know Spina, you might know FRC, functional range conditioning, and that is his practice, his method, which essentially just joint circles. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's got two of them. It's got basically taking your joints through the full range of motion.
That's FRC, right?
Yeah, that's a controlled articular rotations.
Oh, that's cars.
The cars.
Yeah.
And then he's got like the pails and rails.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Which is like, it's like PNF, which probably everybody knows, and I haven't got taught in high school, which is like press against and then relax. Difference is that with PNF, you press against and you relax and you go into a further range. With this one, you press against, but then you actively pull the other way.
Yeah.
So if you were lying down, someone was stretching out your hamstring, rather than pressing into them and then relaxing, you would use your hip flexor to pull your foot off their hand or attempt to, which generally leads to like insane cramping. But it's way harder work than like, I don't know, maybe a rhomboid, like just passive stretching. Yeah, yeah. And you can feel the difference. Like if I do that properly, which I do pretty regularly, like my hips will be sore the next day. Like I'll get DOMS around my hips from doing it right. Or if I stretch out my cuff, I'll get DOMS in my shins from doing it right. So you're actually building the muscles and it sticks way more than passive stretching. So I would, if you're stiff and you're older, I really recommend that.
Yeah, I've heard the saying, Matt used it, strength is loyal. What you're doing is you're strengthening end range of motions. So you're increasing your strength at the end range of motion and even increasing that end range of motion. And if strength is loyal, then what you'll find is that range of motion sticks around.
Good point. Mark Jansen, 14. Tips for training first thing in the morning, not just aerobic work.
Yeah.
Good question, because very common, I think, particularly where we live.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at our gyms, most people train in the mornings. you know, for super,
it is a popular time slot.
And the truth is, like, you know, whether or not it's the most ideal time to train is maybe debatable. But, you know, for most people, it's just the time to get it done. It's a good time. Nothing can really get in the way outside of something happening in the evenings.
Yeah.
So it's a really good time to do it. The one we always talk about, and this is one we educate our clients on, which is just being aware of your spine. So I've seen all different estimates on how long this takes to improve, but because you've been horizontal for so long, basically your spine is like hyperhydrated in the morning. So there's extra fluid in there. So the problem with that is it doesn't move as well as it does once it dehydrates and you've been vertical for a certain period of time. I remember DeFranco used to say, hey, it's like around an hour and a half of like standing up and moving around. How much you actually move makes a big difference. If you like get out of bed and then lie down on your couch for the next hour, you're not really doing much. Yeah. But if you get up, you're on your feet and you're moving around and moving, then that will improve a lot. But basically your spine is going to be stiffer because it's hyperhydrated first thing in the morning. So
which is kind of weird thinking of it because usually hydration means more movement.
Yeah. In this case, it's hyperhydrated, so it doesn't move as well.
Right.
The general recommendation is like an hour and a half.
I think maybe the way to think about it is like all the spinal fluid has settled in one position and what it needs to do is move through all areas of the, like it needs to go into all the discs, all the areas of the disc. It might just be sitting at the bottom, for example. This is some real sketchy science on our perspective.
But if you just take away the main point, which is like don't walk in the gym within an hour of waking up and max out your deadlift.
Yeah.
You need like, ideally you can just get up, you know, as much as possible, like an hour and a half before you actually train.
Yeah.
And do that. And then sticking on the hydration. And for some people, it just you might never pull max weights first thing in the morning. You might be like, hey, I just leave that when I have the time to train in the afternoon.
Yeah.
Afternoon is superior because you've had so much more time to move. Your core body temperature is higher in the afternoon as well, which is a big one. But if you just go to the other pieces, I mean, hydrating in the morning is like a huge battle because like you wake up dehydrated, it's going to take time to hydrate. But I just basically drink as much water as I can as soon as I start the day. So if you're training early, that like you're on a mission from the second you wake up to try and get there. And then in the research, they've shown that it's like, you know how they often show the research that you're more effective in the afternoon compared to the morning?
Yep.
If you have like high doses of caffeine, it like cancels that out. So, like, they usually show, like, over 200 milligrams of caffeine in the morning.
Yeah, but what are they measuring?
Comparing performance between performance morning and afternoon. I think in this one, it was like, what they almost always do. It was, like, interval running, like, 400-meter run time.
So, it was aerobic. Yeah.
Yeah, not 100% aerobic. It was like, 400 meters, so around, like, a minute effort.
Yeah, but it wasn't strength.
No, was it? They almost never do strength.
Yeah. Yeah, look, I would say that my only recommendation is exactly what you were saying, is that... you know, you just need to let go of the fact that it's not a good idea to go heavy in the mornings under any circumstances. I don't know anyone that wakes up in the morning and goes, this is when I feel strongest. This is when I feel best. I pick up the bar and it feels light. My joints don't hurt. Your body is sending you a signal. And unfortunately, due to, you know, lots of different factors, marketing, gym culture, maybe just general kind of education around this particular topic is people try and push through it. And they ignore the signals of their body. They try and drink a pre-workout or they try and, you know, over-warm up or they try and over-activate to kind of blunt out the signals that the body is like, please don't let me get crushed by a barbell this morning. And I can't tell you how many people get injured in the mornings versus in the evenings. It's just because they're not ready for it. And it's not to say you're in the clear in the evenings, but in the mornings, I think you need to take extra precaution. And then, like Raf said, maybe you just let go of the fact that you're not ever going to be your strongest in the morning. And that's okay. Like, would you rather be really strong and then get injured and take 4 or 5 weeks off and just do that on repeat for the rest of your life? Like, that's not very fun. You know, it's better to train consistently, have, you know, good nutrition in the morning, wake up properly. Don't just sit there on your phone for the couch for an hour. Actually move around, get the body ready, take it seriously, and just go at a 70%, at a 60% on the bar, and just keep being able to do that. It's more important.
And you still progress.
You still progress.
Yeah, you just progress with reps.
Yeah.
Okay, Daniel J. Stace. So, curious to find out, after your experiment with plant-based and vegan,
I think referring
to you.
Yeah.
I've experimented, but just on half my plate, the other half had meat on it. Are you following any of these, or do you still suggest protein from meats to lose fat and build muscle?
Okay, so yeah, I wasn't trying vegan to... I was trying vegan to see what it was like to hit macros. And it was really because I have clients coming in that are vegan or want to try it. And I wanted to be able to say, look, I've done it and this was my experience, just to see how difficult it was and if it's easy, if it's hard, if it ruined my digestion. I knew very well, knew going into this, firstly, I'm much more diligent than the average person. I know a lot more about nutrition than the average person. And, you know, vegan is a lot easier in 2020 than it was in, you know, 1990. So a lot of things were stacked in my favor. And, you know, I found there's no doubt you could do a vegan diet and still be extremely healthy. It's just doing that is not only extremely difficult because it requires a lot of cooking skills, which a lot of people don't have in 2020. I'm sorry. Like, I'm not here to bash vegan. I'm just here to say that it is way more difficult than people think. The people that pull it off successfully are outliers. You are outliers, undoubtedly. And most people are not ready for that kind of diet. Like, it's almost, think of like perfect vegan as like the Olympics, and people are starting out day one on the track. You know, they don't know, you know, a carbohydrate or a protein macro or any of that. It's to them, it's just, you know, it's just food, and we need to educate them on the basics. These people don't even drink enough water. And so trying to get them to switch all their nutrition over to plant-based and then hit all the micronutrients, all the macronutrients, all the fat profiles and hit it sustainably. And at the same time, learn more difficult cooking skills. Like, you need to turn like some pretty boring vegetables and stuff into some pretty exciting dishes on a regular basis. And it's tough. It's really, really tough. I found it very difficult to hit the macros. I know a lot of people have messaged me and since saying that they'll do it better. But look, I took the approach that I would go into it with minimal education, because that is the most realistic scenario for most people. Most people go into this stuff with only one or two resources under their belt. They don't go and read four or five vegan books. They don't go and listen to 30 vegan podcasts before trying. They hear a little bit about it. Someone goes, oh, I tried vegan, you know, just cut this out, cut that out, go plant-based. And that's how they give it a crack. And so I think if you're going to try it, you need a lot of prep. You need to do it properly. You need to take it one step at a time. I think you need to ease into it. You need to like maybe go, all right, I'm going to change this snack, or I'm going to change breakfast to vegan, and then I'm going to change lunch, then dinner, and then I'm going to do it 3 days a week, then I'm going to do it 4 days, five, six, 7 days. And so it just takes time. And I think everyone tries to go from 0 to 100, which is how everything is these days, right? Yeah. People want to do it straight away from the beginning. But then to the final point in that question about muscle building is, first, I don't think it's the optimal diet for muscle building, just because it is harder to get a lot of leucine from your protein sources. But you just need, it's not like a vegan diet is better than an omnivorous diet for muscle building. In terms of just like the data, firstly, it'll end up more expensive because the calories are just, will end up being more expensive. But I think it's, you know, a lot of people are trying to pick a diet to build muscle. Muscle building comes down to protein and calories. Like, you can do that on any diet. You can do that on keto. You can do it on paleo. You can do it on the snake diet. If you're getting enough protein and calories, you will increase muscle mass with the right training stimulus. So it's not on any particular diet. Yes, you can do it on vegan. Yes, you can do it on carnivore. Yes, you can do it on you know, paleo, as long as your calories and your protein is high enough. And so I think that's just important for people to know.
Yeah, I think in terms of recommending it to clients, we don't ever really recommend any diets to clients.
No.
Like, we just work with them on the diet there. I couldn't really think of a circumstance. I couldn't really think of any circumstance where I'd be like, oh, this is like the right, you need to go, you got to try the vegan diet or something like that.
Mm.
You know, unless it's like the only circumstance might be just because someone's excited about it. And yeah, I can tell that excitement is going to get them to like take action. I'm like, okay, like,
maybe really might excited. Get them to eat more vegetables.
Yeah, they're like, long-term. Dude, I like saw it, I'm pumped. They'd be like, okay, cool, that's a good idea to recommend it, because it's just going to like get to them some momentum with their health and fitness. And maybe the changes you have was just like too boring for them to take any action. Yeah. But no, it's not like we just like pull random diets off the shelf and start handing them out in the gym.
Yeah. And one thing I will say as well, which obviously doesn't, and I think it just needs to be said, like when you, like, because we've kind of purposely dived into this world of carnivore and vegan diets, and we've had some polarizing figures on in the last sort of months or so, is the vegan community. I think a lot of them are awesome. Like, I know heaps of people that are vegan, and I've nothing bad to say about them or all their food choices. I have no judgment on that. When you have a select few people who are, you know, strongly representing the vegan diet, come on and, you know, say really mean shit, right? Say really hurtful stuff that they would never say to us or whoever they're targeting in person. That is when you give your mission, your brand, or whatever movement you're trying to get other people to. That's when you give it a bad name. Like, that's when you have to take a step back and you have to look. If I came on and when I was in the heart of CrossFit and I went onto bodybuilding pages and I went onto Olympic weightlifting pages and I went onto powerlifting pages and I go, what's your fucking Fran time? Like, you unfit, stupid motherfucker. Like, you're useless, how tight you are. You can't do an overhead squat. How do you think that's going to sit with them? It's not going to sit well at all. And that is what happens. And I think it's unfortunate because there are a lot of plant-based eaters out there who aren't like that at all. And they see people go out there and sort of, I guess, for lack of a better term, defend veganism. Mm. And they do it in such a way that's so mean to whoever they're targeting that they almost shake their heads going, I don't even want to associate with that. And I think that's the problem that happens with a lot of these movements is you do get the extreme people that go on there and rather than come in and create a reasonable argument and they go, hey, look, here are some points, here's some science, maybe you should consider this. Like, I understand what you're saying here, but here's some counter evidence. What do you think? They just go in so hard, like harder than any other movement that we've ever been associated with. We've been in the fitness industry for 12, 13 years. So I don't think anyone that extreme is listening to this podcast right now, potentially. Maybe you are. I would just say, look, no one is listening when you're shouting. Put it that way, right? And when you're being mean, no one's listening, right? They're just nodding their head going, when are you going to fuck off, right? So,
And the people that you can actually convince are the people like that are on the fence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the diehards, like no one's getting convinced either way.
Yeah.
But the people on the fence are the ones you're going to convince, and when they read through the comments, they're just like, this guy seems like he's a psycho.
Yeah, and it turns them off.
Yeah.
And I think if you everyone has good information that they can communicate, and I think it's just getting across in the right way, communicating it the right way is what's most important here.
Okay, Tim D. June. Empty stomachs here. Sorry, question about empty stomachs. Is it true that you don't absorb supplements, multis, vitamin D, omega-3, creatine on an empty stomach? I've heard this, and therefore I don't take them in the morning. Since I do intermittent fasting, but now I tend to forget them quite often and I don't know what's true and actually best. Thanks.
That's actually a good question. We haven't had something like this before. So the two different, obviously when you're doing supplements, there are two different types. There's water soluble vitamins and there's fat soluble vitamins and they're kind of absorbed differently. So water soluble vitamins don't require food to be absorbed. And then fat soluble vitamins are recommended that you do have them with food. So they go across the gut lining with fats in your diet. So it's important to have those with that. So what ones did he recommend there?
He said creatine, which was one of his.
You can have that without.
That can be any time. Multivitamins, which would be a lot of water-soluble vitamins.
Yeah, you can have that.
Vitamin D and omega-3.
Vitamin D is it fat soluble? I think it's fat soluble. I'm not sure. You can obviously look up straight away what they are. But yeah, some you just need to have with food and some without. But if it gives you an upset stomach, definitely don't have it.
A, D, E, and K are all fat-soluble.
Okay. Yeah, D is fat-soluble. So all those ones that are fat-soluble, yeah, have them with food. If they're giving you an upset stomach, it's best not to take them. Anytime something gives you an upset stomach, it's best not to take it. That's pretty...
Yeah.
I think that's everyone would agree on that. So, yeah, just with that process is just learn your body better. And, yeah, the ones that you can take on an empty stomach, take it. The ones that need food, take it with food.
But, you don't even need to eat really food. You could just have, like, a little bit of fat with your vitamins in the morning.
Yeah.
You know, it could be, like, whatever. If you have butter and coffee or coconut oil or whatever, it's going to work well. But it's the same reason why, you know, cooking with some fat when you have vegetables, you do absorb more of the vitamins. Like, having some butter, having some oil in your vegetables is an upgrade compared to, I guess, if you have, like, raw or steamed and it's just completely plain. Like, you get... Tastes better.
Yeah.
For sure. But you actually do get... You get more out of it.
Yeah.
No, that's a good question. Okay, last question. And it's a pretty funny one. So, send us a screenshot here. So, they've got more than... Okay, they've got 27 gyms in total in Denmark. CrossFit Copenhagen, which is... Honestly, amazing effort. We run these sort of gyms ourselves. I imagine that would be very, very tough.
Incredible.
They started 12 years ago, so they got in on the game early, which probably was a helping hand. But on March 30, they will be officially ending their affiliation with the CrossFit brand and adopting a new name, which they have announced, and is ARCA. Maybe that's a different language. I don't know what ARCA means. But that is pretty interesting. Man, it sounds like they have 27 affiliations. So, that is 27 times 3,000, $81,000 US dollars a year. They would have been paying in affiliation fees.
Oh, well, unless they started really early, then they might not all be 3,000.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, they could have a mix. But it's a lot, I think, probably either way.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. And to be honest, I'm super confused, like where CrossFit stands on the whole thing. They don't seem engaged in keeping affiliates. There's not like a huge push. They're not like emailing us every week, like, hey, like, make sure you guys keep your affiliation. It's really important in the way that, you know, most businesses would. Like, if I have a member at the gym and they don't pay $3,000 a year, but or a month, or some do, I guess. Actually, that is kind of what they pay. Mm. But so it's quite similar. For those members, yeah, I put a big effort into them staying.
Mm.
You know, it's important to me that they stay. And if somebody wants to leave, I'd do a pretty big effort, if it's the right thing for them to stay, because that's what the business runs on. So it's like pretty confusing that they, yeah, don't seem really stressed about people leaving. Maybe that's just their philosophy. Hey, do it for as long as you'd like. And if you don't want to do it anymore, feel free.
Yeah.
So they don't seem too stressed about it. Maybe they're just more focusing on different parts of the world. But yeah, I mean, either way, it's a pretty big hit, to the company, CrossFit. But it's also just the way, I mean, it's a very different operation when you have 27 gyms compared to when you have one. When you got one, you're often just trying to be the best CrossFit in your area, and CrossFit brings you in. But I mean, these guys probably know what they're doing, and they're probably trying to build one of the biggest gym brands in Europe.
Mm.
And to build that and have CrossFit in your name is probably, maybe gets confusing for the everyday public, which doesn't know that much about CrossFit or only heard bad things.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's an interesting one. Obviously, it's a lot of gyms, and a lot of affiliation fee. But yeah, I think, like you said, CrossFit they don't really care. They've always had that I don't really care attitude. So, whether you stayed good, whether you didn't matter. But they're definitely not giving any affiliate in particular any support. And if you think they did, then a brand like this would obviously be receiving more support than anyone, because they're paying the biggest fee. But yeah, it's just not a priority for them.
It really seems like that in, you know, maybe 10 years, you'll like walk into a gym and CrossFit will have had such a big effect on the way people train. But like almost no one will know where it came from.
Yeah.
You know, it'll get mixed in, kind of like half someone like, hey, dude, do you know Arnold Schwarzenegger was like the first guy to popularize 3x10? People are like, really? He recommended 3x10? It's like, yeah. It's like the history of it. Probably be like that, you know, where it's like, it has had like undeniable huge effect on the way, like, so many gyms have been impacted in the way they train. You know, even everything down to just like training on the minute is like pretty unique, and the movements and the equipment, like Rogue is everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, it's a CrossFit brand. Yeah. So I do think like the impact is huge and will continue to be huge, but it seems like the actual word is like just disappearing more by the day.
Do you think there will ever be a time where there won't be any affiliates?
It's a good question.
Hmm.
I mean, it's very possible, because potentially if it drops below a certain point, it's not worth them keeping it up. But I mean, it doesn't seem like it, because there are so many affiliates.
There's still heaps,
in like South America and stuff. They are still opening up left, right, and center.
Yeah.
I remember someone told me recently like how many affiliates were in this like area of Brazil. And there are so many.
Well, it's still the most affiliates they've ever had
in
the world. They're just losing heaps in where they started.
Yeah.
In Australia, in America.
Yeah, and probably now by the sounds of things, Europe. So, it's probably just a chain of events. You know, it starts to lose in some areas and it'll flow on.
Yeah, different markets.
Yeah, but there's still a ton in different markets.
Mm. Man, I think as long as the CrossFit Games is going, I think there'll still be affiliates.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay, so next part before we move on to our review of the week, our Netflix review of the week, I should say. We've got the review of the week, which is from Roke, R-O-K-E. Best podcast hands down, but he gives us 4 stars. So he
confusing.
He gives us a little.
I guess he's never given anyone 5 stars.
Gives us a little incentive to put the extra stars. So he says, makes the drives to work informative and with insightful, subjective content ranging across a multitude of subject matter relating to a healthy lifestyle. One star short because I have to listen to the dribble on the radio on the days waiting for new installments. Keep up the good work. So he's a little cheeky stab in there, like, hey, you want the extra star, you gotta release an episode on Tuesday. Unfortunately, we just don't have the time to release that much content, but we would love to. Maybe one day in the future, we will release more, but who knows. So if that was you, send in whatever booster program you would like, and we'll send you that and a digital full digital training journal. So email us in at orders@themindmuscleproject.com. Now, right before this episode, one of our other sponsors, RecGen. RecGen, I'll just quickly talk to you guys about their technology in their clothes. Obviously wanted an apparel sponsor for the longest time, and Quite frankly, I'm embarrassed to wear like multicolored board shorts that a lot of these companies put out, or just like really boxy looking clothes. And so when I found RecGen, it honestly felt like for the first time, someone had just made the brand I've been waiting for. Mm. Like I've been waiting for an athleisure wear company to kind of be catered a bit more towards the guys and the look for guys. Now they are bringing out a women's line in April, but I just wanted something where it was just like, hey, like pastel tones of colors. So what that's like, nothing bright, nothing crazy. Just really nice, simple design and just really good technology in the clothes. I think the vast majority of apparel companies that start up don't have access to these technologies of fabrics because they can't afford it. They're starting on bootstrap budgets. But RecGen is the athleisure version of Zainrobe, which is a huge lifestyle brand. One of their technologies is called Dry Release. It's moisture wicking, 4 times faster drying, active evaporation, highly breathable, easy care, durable fabric. Basically, all that means is like you can just thrash their shirts to death and they don't stink. They wash really easy. They don't deteriorate. They hold their shape. They're super soft. It's like the... I guess it's kind of like the Waterfy of clothes. It's like the best technology in the clothes. You know, it works really smooth. It's just like high level. They're working on it all the time. Like their clothes will last you a long time. Mm. You know, we've talked about this before. Companies like Lululemon, their clothes last a very long time. Lululemon's a girls brand. RecGen is the male Lululemon. So check them out, recgen.com. When you guys check out, they're doing an introductory offer for the My Muscle Project listeners only. You cannot get this discount anywhere else. If you use the code MMP, one word, 3 letters, MMP gets you 20% off your entire order. Wow. Extremely generous. So go check them out. They've got tons of good stuff in stock. I love their stuff. Follow them on Instagram. That's RecGen, RecGen.com.
If you train and sweat, you will not be disappointed.
Not at all.
Okay, so we have both watched the same documentary. We pulled it off this week. Netflix, yes. 6-part docuseries exploring the science of baby and infant development. That is the summary of it. So it basically follows like different babies around the world, which is pretty cool. So like a number of different babies in like all different cultures.
80 babies, I think.
Yeah, it's a ton across all of them. And then like from like really different families, all the way from like two male parents to like really young parents to everything.
Yeah.
Right? And it explores like, it's really, I would say like it's more of a science-y documentary. Like,
for
like,
sure.
It's like really into the science of things and like what we know. And what we don't know about it, and not only the science of the baby, but also the science of the parents.
Mm. Yeah, I think what is, you know, I wonder if it would be an interesting documentary for me if I wasn't in the stage of life where I'm like, oh, yeah, I probably have kids soon. Mm. And then obviously for you, it's like extremely interesting documentary, I have no doubt. And then anyone who's had kids, probably also a very interesting documentary. So I don't know if our Gen Z listeners might enjoy this one as much, but I don't know. But for sure, if you're into science, I think it's particularly interesting. Like the study they did with the hippocampus development and the helicopter parenting, I think that's in episode 2.
Yeah.
Basically, I won't spoil it for you, but if you've always wondered if helicopter parenting... So, helicopter parenting is where like you kind of make decisions for your child. So, if your child is kind of like reaching for something, there's a couple of things in front of them, you just hand them the thing. Or if they look like they're going to cry for like even a little bit, they make a noise, you jump and then you grab them and start soothing them. Like, you're just hanging, hovering over them the whole time to protect them from all things. Like, are there detrimental effects in the brain to doing that? Or maybe not detrimental, but are there actually physiological changes that occur? You'll have to find out and watch the documentary, but very interesting results.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I looked at some stuff like outside of this documentary, and what you find, which is really interesting, is that people overestimate enormously like the positive impacts parents have on kids. So they like most parents think it's like huge impact, like positively what parents can have, but they can have a huge impact negatively if they like abuse their children or something like that.
Of course,
but positively, they say it's like down to like 10%. Like how a child turns out compared to what the parents did for that child.
What do you mean 10%?
Like 10% of the impact. So like 50% is genetics,
yep.
And 50% is nurture. So like straight away, you've taken 50% off the table,
yep.
From what impact you can have. And then there's like peer group, teachers, coaches, idols, like all these other media influences on the kids. And they said like the easiest way you can notice that is, you know, if a parent has two different kids, like, you know, first child, second child, third child, they become enormously different to each other. But their parenting was probably... nearly identical,
right,
or extremely similar.
Yeah.
But how they turn out is just, it's due to all different factors. And people often mistakenly think that it's the parenting, like, so my parents' interest got me into that interest. But right, very often it's just genetics.
Right.
Because they'll find that, you know, even adopted kids end up quite similar to the parents, even though they never met them, because the genetics are similar.
Right.
They obviously don't go directly.
All quite similar to their birth parents.
To their birth parents.
Right. Yeah.
Probably more similar to their birth parents than the parents that raised them, because they share such a similar genetic profile. So it's pretty interesting. And then what I took out of the documentary is how, like, once you actually have the kid, it changes the mum and dad forever as
well. The amygdala activation. Yeah, so the amygdala, which is your reptile brain, which is your fight or flight center, it switches on all the time for the woman now. You know how, like, guys always say, oh, you know, once she had a child, like, she changed completely. Like, that,
I remember I remember my dad saying that as well, yeah.
No, like, it's full legit. Like, their amygdala is on forever now. Mm. Like, it can't switch off. It's, like, crazy. And, you know, the kind of the funny story of the mum that's, like, always paranoid. Remember this? Remember that? Yeah. You know, it's like, that is because a part of her brain switched on and never switched off. And it's just, like, they are literally changed forever.
Well, I thought also one of the good parts was that they were saying that even if, like, you don't actually give birth to the child, like, say you adopt a child from first day, you still have those effects.
Yep.
That it's more of like a choice thing to be looking after a young person, not like a straight biological thing.
Which is like super interesting for parents that like don't participate in their children's lives. Mm. It's like doesn't occur to them. It's like even if though it's their genetics and it's happening for the kid, for the parent, it's just another day. If they're not involved in the life, it doesn't actually matter, which is crazy. Yeah, check it out. Babies on Netflix?
Yeah, it's Babies. I would say as well, it always starts a bit slower. I would give it some time and the episodes get better.
Episode 2 is sick.
Yeah.
Yeah, episode 2 is sick. I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5.
Yeah, I'm also going to give it a 4. I think as well, as like if you're in the process of it, some of the things in there are also like controversial. Like not everyone agrees with like everything that's in the movie. Yeah. So you just got to just enjoy it.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, guys. So, we do have the programs being released very soon. I think they'll probably be out in 2 weeks, but we will inform you of those when they're released. So, we have a body composition program. So, for those of you who are looking to build a lean muscular physique, so people who want to get strong, and then people who want to increase their fitness. So, 3 programs, and they will be released very soon. We took all your feedback in of the pricing and the app and everything. So, we're kind of catering it all perfectly to you guys. So, look out for those.
Awesome.
All right, guys. Speak to you next week. Thank you, Project, for tuning in again to another episode of the My Muscle Project. We release an episode every single Monday. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, the My Muscle Project, to stay up to date with everything we're doing. And if you have some time, leave us a review and a 5-star rating on iTunes.
And don't forget, we have a second show of the week, The After Show. So, it's no longer a rest day on Thursdays. If you have any questions for Lachlan and I for that show, head to themindmuscleproject.com/theaftershow. And if you ask a question, we'll answer it on the show.
Thanks again so much, Project, and we'll see you all next week.